Okay. This is Monday, the 15th of August, 2005. We're at the Freiburg New Church Assembly. This is 11 o'clock, the second lecture of the week. Our theme being the doctrine of charity. My name is George Dole. My title is The Good of Love and the Truth of Faith. Well, from time to time, I find myself wondering what would happen if we asked 20 well-read Swedenborgians to define the phrase, the good of love. I wonder how welcome the task would be, how difficult people would find it, and I wonder particularly, of course, how their definitions would compare with each other. The words themselves are very simple. They're certainly common ones. I doubt, though, that this particular combination can be found in any frequency anywhere outside the Swedenborgian world. Swedenborgians would probably have a little easier time with the parallel phrase, the truth of faith, or truths of faith, but as I'll be explaining later, I'm not sure we tend to have it right. I think we tend to misconstrue it. One of the blessings of this computer age is that it's now possible to search the Latin text of Swedenborg's theological works far more thoroughly than has ever been the case before. And one of the mixed blessings of this is that it's now possible to pile on statistics, number upon number. So I can tell you that the phrase traditionally translated the good or the goods of love occurs 1,626 times in the singular, 182 in the plural for a total of 1,808, and that the phrase traditionally translated the truth or truths of faith occurs 2,095 times, 988 in the singular, and 1,107 in the plural. Well, this does tell me some things I think are interesting. One, that the two phrases are quite frequent, that they're roughly equally frequent. There's certainly a predominance, you know, truths of faith comes out ahead, but not by an overwhelming margin. It isn't a rout. And that truth is far more likely to be pluralized than good. I'm grateful for the latter fact because while the Latin phrase traditionally translated the goods of love is perfectly good Latin, the English phrase the goods of love is appallingly bad English. We do, of course, have an English word goods, and according to the dictionary, it means articles for sale or for use. The Latin word is just the plural of the adjective that means good, and it means things that are good, just as the neuter plural of the adjective for true would mean things that are true. So if our translators had really been consistent, we would have the goods of love and the truths, T-R-U-E-S, of faith, and we'd realize, well, abominable, an English translation, the goods of love is. But they took advantage of the fact that the noun truth can mean something that is true, and so it is a decent translation of the plural adjective. The basic rule for English is that when an adjective is used as a noun, it can stand for either singular or plural, and more often than not, serves as a kind of collective and therefore stands for the plural. So no matter how many free, brave people we have in this country, we do not talk about the land of the frees and the home of the braves. No. No.
Unless you're in Cleveland.
or polar, for the land of the frees in some polar part of the country. Yeah, yeah. So we move a little way toward understanding if we use the clumsy phrase, the good things of love. And this has the merit of raising a very important question, namely, what good things? What are we talking about? And we need to bear constantly in mind that Swedenborg is talking about our own lives and our own experiences. So this phrase, the good things of love, is like a blank that we should be able to fill in with something we've observed today. Hopefully something that we observe fairly often. This raises the further question of where in our lives we should look. And the obvious answer is, I think, that we should look in the general nature, neighborhood of love. There are, after all, good things of love. And that leads us into the thick of the translator's nightmare, the world of prepositions. Because we are quite defensibly using the preposition of to translate the Latin genitive case. Now, I won't take you into the wilds of the. That's the toughest word in the whole thing, except to say that it is at least as elusive as of. Now, I suspect that whatever grammatical and lexicographical errors you may be prone to, you don't misuse little words like in and of. Because they're so little and so familiar, there's a tendency to think of them as simple or easy. But they aren't. Look up a hard word, like doxastic. I just ran across it. That's just a great word. It means relating to belief. That's pretty straightforward. And the definition is that short. Now look up the preposition of. You find something very different. Hold that phrase, the good things of love, in your mind and see which of the following dictionary definitions of seems to work. Of, used between two nouns, the second providing more information about the first. Okay. Used to indicate the person or thing affected by or performing an action. No? Used after words or phrases expressing quantities to indicate the substance or thing being measured. You know, a cup of sugar. Used to indicate the place that somebody or something belongs to or is connected with. Containing the substance mentioned? No, I doubt it. Used to indicate a part of something that is normally considered as a whole. Made from or used as a material to form something. Let me speed up, this is going to take too long. Used to indicate a relationship, association, or cause. Used after words describing feelings and qualities to indicate the person or thing they relate to. Used to describe somebody or something in terms of a particular type or kind. Used to indicate a quality that somebody or something has, or the person or thing having a particular quality. Used to indicate an amount, age, or value. Used to indicate a day or other period of time when an activity regularly occurs. Before the hour of, as in 10 of 12. Used to indicate the agent of an action. That's the list, but not really. Prepositions tend to cover a lot of ground and to be very difficult to divine, find precisely and completely. Very strangely, for example, this list seems to omit one of the most common usages, and that's just plain possession, belonging to. And I think it also omits the meaning that works best in the phrase, the good things of love, namely, resulting from, as in the thrill of victory, the agony of feet, the defeat, the joy of cooking, or the heartbreak of psoriasis. That comes out of my youth. Yeah. After struggling then with the goods of love for most of my years as a translator, I've come to believe that the phrase means essentially the good effects of love, the good that love does, the good things that love does. Then the plural makes a real sense. The clearest suggestion of this I've found in the published works themselves is in TCR 361, and I quote, "To the extent that faith and caring become spiritual for us, we are drawn out of our self-consciousness and do not focus on ourselves, on being rewarded or repaid, but only on the simple pleasure of perceiving the true things of faith and doing the good things of love." There's also the fact that fruit corresponds to the good of love. I have references here. And also very commonly to good works. You shall know them by their fruits. So any good thing that I do or say out of love is the fruit of love. It is a good of love. And in fact, love does all kinds of good things. It obviously does generous acts and says considerate, thoughtful things, but it brings comfort in distress, calm in times of anxiety, hope in times of discouragement, healing in times of sickness, support in times of distress and fear. It reassures us when we doubt our worth. It listens to us when we long to be heard. It looks for genuine understanding. And all such effects, I think, are the good things of love. So going back a few paragraphs, I think now we can see that the good things of love is a blank that we can fill in with something we've observed today, and or it is to be hoped with things that we observe fairly often. And we can also be more precise about at least one of the places to look for these good things, namely in our relationships with each other, which shouldn't come as a surprise, because after all, the central purpose of the Lord's creation is a heaven from the human race, and heaven is above all a community. It's heaven not simply because its inhabitants are individually good, but because that goodness takes the form of caring about each other, because their hearts are open to each other, because the joy of each is the joy of all, and the joy of all is the joy of each. And the goal of regeneration is not some kind of private, self-sufficient bliss. We are accepted into heaven when and only when we accept heaven into ourselves, which is saying that the goal of regeneration is to open our hearts to each other, to let each other in, to let the community into ourselves. Well, there's more to it than that. The goal of regeneration is to open our hearts and our minds to each other. It's not only to love and to be loved, it is to understand and to be understood. Which this was something that the Apostle Paul, I think, got exactly right. For now we see in a mirror, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part, then I will know fully, even as I am fully known. Now, if you're at all like me, you've more or less assumed that the truths of faith were the teachings of the church. And wonderful as those teachings are, they themselves tell us that they're useless unless they're applied to our lives. That's what they tell us time after time. Let me give one example. Very clearly in DLW 78, it does seem as though deity were not the same in one person as in another, for example, in a wise individual, in a simple one, in an old one, in an infant. This is just the way things seem, though, and it is illusory. The individual is a receptor, and the receptor or receiver does vary. A wise person is receptive of deity more adequately and therefore more fully than a simple one, and an individual who is both old and wise than an infant or child. Still, deity is the same in the one as it is in the other. So on the metaphysical principle that deity is infinite, it must be wholly present everywhere, and in fact, the passage from DLW goes on to say that deity is also the same in things that aren't alive. Well, it's one thing to accept this on metaphysical or theological grounds, though. It's another thing to see, or at least try to see, or suspect the presence of deity in each other and in ourselves. And if we don't, then the doctrine is disconnected from our lives, and that is what our theology refers to and condemns as faith alone. And this, together with the parallelism between the true things of faith and the good things of love, has prompted me to look for examples of these true things of faith in the same area as the good things of love, namely in our relationships with each other. And for that matter, our relationships with ourselves. It's immensely important, the growth of human community, the presence of heaven, depends on our seeing each other and ourselves as clearly and honestly as we can, which means seeing each other and ourselves in the light of our faith. To put it bluntly then, one of the most important categories of truths or true things of faith is our perceptions, day by day, of ourselves and each other. And this is very strongly suggested, at least, by the passage in TCR that I cited earlier, which referred to the simple pleasure of perceiving the true things of faith and doing the good things of love. That sounds like something that happens as we go along in life, not something just as we're sitting and reading those books. It calls, I'm afraid, for a digression. There is a nice Latin verb, percipio, that looks a lot like the English word perceive, and apparently means something fairly similar. The first meaning given for it in Chadwick's Lexicon of Swedenborg's Theological Latin, though, gives it a particular nuance, quote, to become aware of, perceive, parentheses, a feeling or sensation, close quote. The second meaning is to become intellectually aware of, to perceive, to grasp. In other words, the more intellectually focused meaning of percipio, according to Chadwick, is secondary. And the primary meaning has to do with our feelings. And this is the clear implication of Secrets of Heaven 26:19. What is good is the basis of our perceiving. I'll use that as a translation. While what is true is the basis of our thinking, close quote. So the noun perceptio, the genitive case of, with a genitive case perceptionis, which has all the letters of perception right in the same order, probably means something much more like sensitivity. Now, sensitivity feeling training is a very lively field of activity these days. It would more appropriately, I think, be called sensitivity retraining, since our childhood experiences have trained us to be sensitive to some things more than to others. In the language of the 60s, we pick up some vibes far more readily than others. And I sometimes think of us as diagnostic machines tuned to particular issues and pretty oblivious to others. An electroencephalograph is sensitive to very subtle brain impulses, but don't expect it to tell you your blood pressure. It won't. So what about our sensitivities to each other's thoughts and affections? How well do we read each other? How well do we diagnose? What signals are we sensitive to? And there's clearly a wide and often clearly observable range from insensitivity to hypersensitivity, as well as wide variations in our selectivity. And these differences have immense effects on the process of building heavenly community. I've got to digress, tell a story from the dining room years and years ago, which Nancy will appreciate, Nancy Perry. I was giving a lecture and I made a grammatical error. It was a long sentence and I heard the voice of Nancy's mother from the back saying, "None are." Now, she was sensitive to certain things that nobody else in the room was sensitive to. Yeah. And Swedenborg makes a remark about people who pass judgment on a whole speech or on the basis of a single grammatical peculiarity. It happens. Yeah. So, if these true perceptions are as important as I think they very obviously are, then we should expect our theology to talk about them, to tell us so. But apart from giving attention to periodic self-examination as a prelude to repentance, there seems at first sight to be not all that much. But if the true things of faith, if that phrase includes our perceptions and interpretations of our circumstances, includes our sensitivities, includes the light in which we see the world and each other and ourselves, then 2,095 times the writings are turning our attention to that. We can fill in the blank labeled the truths of faith with all our moments of clarity, all the realizations that dawn on us, all the moments when we glimpse the pricelessness of someone near us, all the times when we can see what needs to be done, when we can hear what needs to be said, all the times we glimpse the hand of the Lord's providence. The list could go on and on. It's a huge blank, but it's easy to fill in. So the main question then can be put very directly. How consistently good are we at seeing ourselves and each other in the light of our faith? How consistently good are we at seeing our choices in the light of our faith? If a recipe calls for mushrooms, we obviously need to know a mushroom when we see it. If a recipe for charity calls for recognizing the good in another, we obviously have to know that good when we see it, which is quite clearly put in paragraph 24:17 of Secrets of Heaven. If our sole focus is on the faith side of our theology, the only form of charity to the neighbor we recognize is giving to others and feeling sorry for everyone, since we call everyone neighbor without making any distinctions. But charity is everything that is good in us, in our affection, our commitment, and therefore in our life. And the neighbor is everything that is good in the others whom we encounter, and this with all kinds of distinctions, which is what I would like to think of as the spiritual basis of support groups, that is, gatherings of people who have been through similar circumstances, similar experiences, and are therefore sensitive to each other's feelings, who know how to read those signals. Books may give very accurate and insightful analyses of what people go through, say, with the death of a child or the loss of a limb, but someone who has gone through the experience will be a diagnostic instrument that will pick up signals that the readers may very readily miss. I referred earlier to Paul's statement, "Then I will know fully, even as I am fully known." Before I get to the last point I want to make, I would be remiss if I didn't stress that this is a double-barreled statement, that the second barrel is just as important as the first. The process of judgment that we face in the world of spirits is simply the coming to light of what lies under the surface of our visible deeds and our audible words. It struck me recently that the reason nothing unclean enters into the holy city, even though the gates are wide open day and night, is that the city is filled with the light of faith, with the light of the glory of God. And the Gospel of John tells us, "For all who do evil hate the light and do not come to the light, so that their deeds may not be exposed." And we can't see then others in the light of faith unless we ourselves enter into that light and allow ourselves to be seen in that light. And this brings me to the last point that I want to make, which I hope is pretty obvious by now, namely that the truths of faith come from the goods of love. It's said so many times in our theology that my only problem is choosing which passage to cite. Secrets of Heaven 97:23, this will do. I'll give you the traditional translation first. It sounds something like this. This is how it works for us with the truths of faith and the goods of love when we are being regenerated. The good of love chooses suitable truths of faith for itself and uses them to complete itself. This means that the good of love is in the first place and the truth of faith is in the second. Now let me paraphrase this in more experiential language. This is the working relationship between the way we see each other in the light of our faith and the way we express our love when we're in the process of regeneration. Our effort to express our love picks up the signals that it is looking for in the light of our fundamental values and uses those signals as guides to fulfilling itself. This means that our effort to express our love is in the driver's seat, and our faith-based perceptions are secondary. Well, I find it obvious, that is, that when we're truly concerned with someone who is dear to us, we are particularly attentive to that individual. We want, above all, to understand, not to get the answers that tell us what we want to hear, but to know what is really going on. And on the other hand, when our concern is primarily for ourselves, we want to be reassured, we want to be confirmed, we want our own opinions supported, so we fish for particular responses and discourage others. And our affections, our intentions are in the driver's seat. Well, if I read Swedenborg this way, I don't read very fast. I don't read very much before I run into something that makes me stop and look and listen. You may have heard me pose the question, if you memorized the entire theological corpus but misunderstood the words good and true, how well would you understand what you had read? And what would be the use of that knowledge? It's actually not easy to find definitions of those words in the theological works themselves. Swedenborg is not big on definitions. He depends on the cumulative effect of description of situation and circumstance and relationship after relationship. We can look these things up in the dictionary, of course, but the definitions that matter are the definitions we live by. So we are choosing our personal definitions by living as though certain values are in fact good and certain opinions are in fact true. And the whole process of regeneration hinges on our willingness to bring those choices out of our inner privacy and look at them in the light of our faith for the sake of love. And the next page is page one. So the floor is yours. Yeah.
Commenting on the very last thing you said, the flip side or another side, perhaps, of good being in the driver's seat is statements that Swedenborg makes that if there is not love or goodness in our truth, it ceases to be true.
Yeah.
Because in the traditional translations, it becomes perverted.
Yeah.
I would say corrupted or distorted would be another word, that if we aren't that basically faith alone is actually impossible, that yeah. You cannot have faith without love, because if there is not love in it, it's no longer true and it's no longer faith. And I've had to think about that a lot, because we tend to think, you know, I can know the truth even if I don't want it or do it. I suspect we can't. I suspect that when we think we know the truth but we have no interest in doing it, we don't really know the truth. And the distinctions between knowledge and understanding and wisdom strike me as perhaps a way to understand this somewhat, that knowledge is simply having facts in our brain, understanding is being able to put them together in some order, and wisdom is actually doing something good with them.
Yeah.
And you get the distinct impression that knowledge and understanding aren't really truth.
Yeah. You know, there is one of my favorite chunks in the writings is the collections at the end of Heaven and Hell 356 on, quote, knowledges. And these are extracts from the Arcana, from Secrets of Heaven. And one of them is, roughly, I can't give it to you precisely, the same information that is true for good people is false for evil people because it's put to an evil use. And this if you substitute for good people, evil people, the same information that is true for us when we're good is false for us when we're being evil.
Which is something to put in your pipe and smoke. It's hard to fathom, but then when you think about your attitude toward another person and what you know about their character, including their shortcomings, and think about how the Lord and the angels look at that person, knowing the person's shortcoming, whereas it's how a person who hates their guts looks at them.
Absolutely.
And it becomes distorted in that all of a sudden the evil things are the primary characteristic of that person, whereas at the deepest level that's simply not true, that even the worst devil in hell has that inviolable goodness which is at the center. And the Lord still looks at that when he looks at them, but when we look at them, we say, that's an evil person.
Yeah. Well, it's distorted even more fundamentally than that, because when we're in that mood or that attitude of wanting to see the evil in another person, we are delighted by that evil. Mm-hmm. We see that as good. Oh, good.
Oh, good. They're such a jerk.
Yeah. And it is just totally, totally inverted.
My favorite one on that is it good to tell the truth?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Richard has the answer.
Yes and no. I've been trying to think. You mentioned perception, it's interesting. Perception has something to do with experience, and something to do with memory, and then something else. I mean, like if, for example, you go out and you haven't experienced mosquitoes before, you'll just go out there and say, oh, look at all those things flying around. But once you've bitten, you go out there and you have the perception to know what might happen. But there are obviously various levels of perception, and it becomes more... undefined, difficult to explain what that is when we talk in a spiritual sense as to what is perception and how is the reality of the truth as we learn it from experience and we read about it applied, so that somehow this is a sort of a question. It doesn't really come over as a question, but it is a question. There has to be some aspect of how the Lord comes into it directly. Is that true?
Yeah. What was crossing my mind was the picture Swedenborg gives of the decline in the earliest history, that the earliest people had perception that this gradually declined and was replaced by conscience. And I read that perception as meaning a direct sense, an immediate sense of the quality of themselves and of other people, which really is seeing and feeling themselves in the context of the Lord's presence. Because the Lord is the qualities that set the standard, in a sense. It is the Lord's love that defines what is good. And our perceptions and our sense of quality is accurate to the extent that we perceive as good what is in accord with the quality of the Lord's being. Applies particularly in the interpretation or understanding of what it means to in the Gospels. If you ask for anything in my name, I will give it. I will grant it. Well, that's, I think you could find thousands of examples a day of instances where you cannot take that literally, where people have asked things in Christ's name, and in Protestant churches. Time after time, prayers end, in your name we pray. How many of those prayers are literally answered? But any prayer that is asked in the quality is granted.
I was struck by your term resensitivity training, and I just want to mention that it seems like the whole process of regeneration is each of us practicing our resensitivity training that we must all work on.
Yeah. One of the images I've liked very much, I read about some time, is that there, and you can check this out very readily with a book, that the only area of the retina where the photosensitive cells are dense enough, fine-grained enough to discern detail is in the center of the retina, the area called, I think, the fovea or the macula, one or the other. And that comprises 1/40,000th of the total retinal area. We perceive detail in 1/40,000th of our perceptual field. And we are the ones who choose what 40,000th of the field we're going to look at and focus on. We are immensely selective. I mentioned a book. You can test this very readily. Take a page, a printed page, look at one letter, and without taking your eyes off that one letter, see how many words you can read. It's tiny. We get the impression of looking at this and seeing the whole thing in detail. We supply the detail by scanning. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a Debbie.
I thought it very interesting that when you said that Swedenborg wasn't very good about defining the words that he uses.
Yeah.
And that's one of the challenges I have, is I would love to read the writings with a nice list of definitions right next to me.
Yeah, yeah.
And the two that you talked about today, the goods of love and the truths of faith, I always stumble, and I always have to go back, and I need to think, okay, so what does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, so I'd really appreciate you working up a list of definitions that you can just let us read the writings with right on the right-hand side, so that, you know, I can take that bookmark with me as I read, so there's a job for you. But I appreciated especially your definition of goods of love and the good effects of love. That's something I think I can hold on to. Mm-hmm. And thank you very much for doing that. And I loved your image of evil spirits in the holy city. That was something really visual. And thank you for that.
Yeah. Actually, I forget where Bill Woffenden did one sort of glossary. There is a book by J. Stuart Boggs, known as Boggs Glossary, and I keep wanting to say Glog's Bossary. It's so much better. But they don't work very well, because Swedenborg is not a consistent terminologist in a great many ways.
I just had a comment that I work with graduate students in their thesis, and I insist that they start a glossary of terms, because the word nature has 50,000 definitions.
Yeah.
And maybe it's each person has to come up with what the definition is. So it'd be nice if, when people do define a term, they would put it into a glossary, and maybe a year or two from now we put those glossary of terms up of how various people have defined the terms in order to work through things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to steal something from my next lecture at this point, because I've come to want to make a distinction between words and terms. Terms are, of course, words, but think of terms as words that are defined by their boundaries and that do not overlap, scientific terms. You either are a vertebrate or you are not, and so on. Whereas words are defined by their center and overlap all over the place. They have extended meanings. If I can remember correctly, the adjective light, we can have a light souffle, light cavalry, or light humor. There is a central common meaning, but the same definition won't work in each of them. And I can refer to our cat as a pet, a pest, in all sorts of words. The cat will fit in all sorts, under all sorts of words. And words are like that, and this is great. And they do have a remarkable precision if you can get nailed down what that center is. But then once you have that center, you do need to recognize that there are very tightly defined central meanings, there are extended meanings, there are metaphorical meanings, which are essential, because experience never precisely repeats itself. So no two cats are identical. And you're going to need different words. The cat won't do all the time, won't say everything that needs to be said. And I think Swedenborg used words far more than he used terms. And sometimes he, as Bill Woffenden was fond of pointing out, he'll give you a wonderful definition and you'll never find the word used meaning exactly that again in the whole thing. Yeah. Yeah.
When I was translating The Heavenly City and also every time reading it, I have this feeling I'm getting to a certain passage fairly early on where he says, nothing is more important than knowing what is good or what good is and what is truth. And yeah, you read and you think, finally he's going to tell us.
Yeah.
And then he goes on to, and how they relate to one another. Then he goes on to say, well, they relate to each other just as love and wisdom do. And darn, I was so looking forward to the definition. And I also reflect on the fact that he often uses these substantive adjectives. And I think you've said this before, or somebody has, that perhaps they aren't things that are really meant to be defined as this is what I mean when I say this, but rather things in which you're supposed to fill in the blank.
Yeah.
That it's not the most important thing is to know what's good and true. Therefore, you need to go out and experience what's good and what's true and then fill it in where I use these terms or words, as you're saying now. So when I feel a sense of wanting to give to another person, I'm experiencing love. Now put that in here when I say love, and then you'll have some idea of what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I've finally understood how to get along with my spouse in this particular instance. Now take that insight that you had and plug it in where I say truth, and then you're going to have some idea of what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And what I've the way I've said this in our NCE meetings is that I have to go through at least two stages in trying to deal with the meaning of a word. I have to look it up in Chadwick, and I have to look it up in George. And if I can't do both, then I haven't figured out what it means.
And I still have a sneaking suspicion that many of our translators simply did not really understand what they were translating. They were translating terms and words phrases, but not ideas, and that you simply can't understand Swedenborg unless you've had some experience of the things he's talking about.
Yeah.
Why is it that some people with eighth grade educations devour this stuff and can't get enough of it and think it's fantastic, and other people who've gone through 12 years of college scratch their head and say, what in the world is he talking about?
Yeah, well, if it takes you 12 years to get through college, Lee. And Swedenborg has some fairly scathing things to say about people who get hung up on terms. And says there's one about the Aristotelians who proceed from terms to thoughts instead of from thoughts to terms. And I think it says if you led them to the proper path, they'd turn the wrong way on it. something to that effect. But I find myself realizing that as translator, there is no way I can make every sentence totally self-explanatory. And so that taken out of its context, it says everything that it's trying. You can hear everything it's trying to say. The total effect is cumulative. You read and you read and you keep. Because you keep seeing, accuse him of being repetitive. Well, bless his soul, we need it. See, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to say one more. And I sort of suspect that this has something to do with the other statements that if you think you have the truth but you don't have love, you don't even know what the truth is. And key that in with other ones that say if you have love but you don't act on it, you don't really have love, and you get a picture that says if we don't have some experience of living these things, we simply don't understand them.
Right. Right. How would you like to have had the last word?